Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Don Nelson and Dave Bennett have died. Don was 88, a giant of a man, who crossed the Columbia River Bar a record 50,000 plus times, delivering pilots onto and off incoming and outgoing ships. Dave was 82, for much of his life a radio officer aboard ships crossing the world's oceans, until he was rendered obsolete by digital communications. Shanghaied and Astoria fans know him as Diamond Dave for his banjo and ribald ballads. KMUN listeners know him for his love of classical music, especially Mozart, who was his main man. God rest those two merry gentlemen, which indeed they were. I start today's program with a poem by Arthur Honeyman. A yellow ribbon stands for peace rather than military victory, and that is what I support. I am filled with vile stomach sickness at the starkly ashamed revelation that compatriots of the most sophisticated civilization known would and did commit the most barbaric act of slaughter since and including the invasion of Pearl Harbor and perhaps in all of history, and I sincerely hope that you understand me when I shriek to you a gut-level plea to end the insanity that requires blood spilling and people butchering and all atrocities against life, for slaughter is not just. And let me show you with tears, if I must, that I also support United States troops and all the troops around the entire world, for they are all people like you and me. And let me get on my knees and beg you to save the lives by bringing them home, now and alive and whole and in peace, not later or in fragments or piece by piece, and see how fulfilled and proud you feel, adorned with the yellow ribbon of peace. Arthur wrote this poem during the first Persian Gulf War in January 1991. It will act as prologue to what might stand as a manifesto for his very useful and well-regarded life. I think it will rightly define the spirit of his 76th birthday, which would have been next Wednesday, May 10th. He was born in 1940 and died in December 2008. Many of you might remember him as the motive force of spastic power, which he said was probably irrational, but so is love. He was born with cerebral palsy and spent most of his life struggling for the rights and equality of persons born with innate handicaps, or as Joanne Halverson has said, people with disabilities. He wrote what I am going to read today that same year of 1991. He printed it as a pamphlet, and it was twice published in the North Coast Times Eagle. As a step forward in human evolution, envision peace, not war, is inevitable, by Arthur Honeyman. The Judeo-Christian culture, in which the heritage of hundreds of millions, if not billions, of citizens the world over, for Islam is as Judeo-Christian as Christianity and Judaism, are mutually ingrained with the labyrinthine notion that war is inevitable because of the cultural emphasis placed on the individual's value as opposed to the value of the whole, which includes the environment and extends infinity into realms beyond our fathoming. This has been a boon to humanity in countless ways, but it has also become a curse. While individuals have explored through human-made science avenues, dimensions, and technologies that have saved and enhanced lives immeasurably, this same science has also destroyed much of our instinctive awareness of our life source and our relationship to it. The Messiah and the laboratory mice have stolen into the night, taken with them our commonality with the universe. In an era when knowledge of the cosmos is expanding with incredible rapidity, we appear to be no closer to unraveling the secrets of the universe than we were thousands of years ago. Likewise, in an era when technology makes it possible to communicate with each other from opposite sides of the globe merely by pushing the right buttons before transmitting or interneting our words and voices anywhere on the planet virtually instantaneously, the same technology and all its power is revealed to us in chaos and obliteration, which metaphors apocalyptic visions of a self-proclaimed Messiah, whose Father art in heaven, quote, unquote. This is the same heaven where Christians, Jews, and Muslims expect to dwell in the house of the Lord after the annihilation, which the Good Book predicted 3 millennia ago. Perhaps it is such beliefs, the notion that the faithful and anointed are destined to eternal paradise after life, that induces people to be oblivious to their relationship with their brethren around the world. But I am inclined to believe the opposite is the case, that the act of losing touch with the fundamental relationship with all existence induces these lonely individuals to seek solace in imaginary extra-celestial paradise. But whichever is the case, the result seems that humanity is determined to annihilate everything that stands in the way of its supremacy, even though it would mean self-destruction. Humanity virtually puts this goal into words every time someone espouses the belief that war is inevitable. But lest it be suggested that I have naively forgotten that wars have been on every continent since the dawn of human existence, and that no civilization, culture, nation, or religion is not guilty of engaging in and or somehow promoting war at some point in history, this factor looms inescapably evident in my animus nessus. The gods of Buddhists, Hindus, pagans, pantheists, Shintoists, Taoists, etc., have long accompanied fierce warriors into battle and onto conquest and often brutal oppression. History also shows us that more civilized nations are sometimes more cruelly repressive than primitive ones. But I believe I am not alone in my observation that even the unconscionable assault on Pearl Harbor was not nearly as devastating or as inhumane as the atom bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Although it may seem so, my purpose here is not to accuse or condemn. Rather, I am attempting to make and substantiate the argument that sophisticated civilization and its technology, along with its zealous monotheism, has inadvertently divorced itself from the core of existence in an effort to achieve political, social, and spiritual supremacy. It so happens that the West achieved modern technological superiority prior to the East, which at that time was at peace and committed to cultural isolation. Scientific 18th century Westerners, along with their mono-god, which oddly was also a tri-god, were restless and somewhat perplexed and resentful of the notion that the path to peace and nirvana is through accepting one's relationship with the forces of nature. And so I conjecture that Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman culture and its quest for the conquest of nature has resulted in near total disregard for the phenomenon of existence and all its variations. For example, when Europeans arrived in North America in the colonial era of the 17th and early 18th centuries, they may have been initially enchanted with what they perceived as the Garden of Eden, innocence of the natives and their harmonious relationship with their natural surroundings. Their manifest acceptance of harsh conditions, as well as deeply appreciative reverence for the bounty of the land, a reverence so profound and personal, they sought to waste nothing and to immediately replace that which they borrowed from the earth. Unlike the 10th and or 11th century Viking colonists, whose pagan beliefs may have been fierce and uncompromising, but were also inescapably interrelated with the forces of nature in a personal and immediate sense, these Christian Europeans were byproducts of classical science and had progressed so far from the book of Genesis that they forgot its message about innocence and temptation. Armed with the ideals and powers of religious zeal and the knowledge of skills of classical analysis, these refugees from tyranny and persecution fervently blinded themselves to the accommodating lands on this continent, its warm native societies, and their favorable relationship with their environment. Instead, what the European newcomers saw was a laboratory, a golden opportunity to advance and experiment with their own grandiose idea of the way things ought to be. Almost immediately, they perpetrated separation from their environment, just as their cultural antecedents had done beginning with the tribes of Abraham. They built walls and fortified them, treating with the natives only when it was to their advantage. In a sense, that could be interpreted as a declaration of war. As a proud descendant of English and Scottish immigrants endowed with the traditions and education of a neoclassical heritage, I can attest to personal difficulties in avoiding the secure, though uptight, walls of analysis and classification, which tends to give me the illusion that I, as an individual, necessarily stand alone as separate entity, and that, by God, I had better overwhelm mine enemies before they overwhelm me. Without apologizing for being proud of my personal skills and strengths, I have long erroneously assumed that strife means war, when actually it only means struggle or turmoil. I have long associated the natural instinct for personal survival with a lust for power and the inevitability of war. I have long understood the major difference between war and peace is that war is temporary, whereas peace, by virtual definition, is intrinsically eternal, or in colloquial earthly imagery, forever. If it's not forever, it's not truly peace, not truly. As a self-proclaimed atheist, I have made the mistake of disavowing the notion that anything lasts forever. That is one area in which Judeo-Christian religionists possess a greater understanding than I do. I believe in evolution, and since I also believe human evolution is strongly influenced by past, present, and future cultural and social behavior and beliefs, I must also believe in my personal ability to make a quantum leap in order to break the impasse, which previously prevented my total belief in the possibility and the inevitability of global peace, for we shall achieve it, either through the complete and personal worldwide understanding or through global obliteration. Firm in the belief that planetary obliteration is neither necessary or acceptable, I am in the process of exploring and developing an unorthodox, though far from original, theory or series of theories or foundation on which to construct avenues toward world peace. Since peace is a new field of endeavor for me and will therefore require a considerable amount of groping on my part, much of what I express here will also be new to me. In the hope that these ideas will be worthy of considering, they should also be taken with a grain of salt, for I am no Dag Hammarskjöld. In the land of orthodox negotiation and international diplomacy, my ideas are not germane. I suppose the key to understanding what I am thinking about peace is to be aware that I strongly believe war and other forms of mass murder are not part of the biological makeup of humanity. And further, even if science should determine a DNA linkage to mass violence, it is still possible to bring such behavior to a cessation, if not through science, then through evolution via exercise of restraint, which would eventually lack the need for the function and render it biologically obsolete. But without belaboring the question of whether or not war is inherent in human nature, I assert that it is not. I sincerely believe the key to world peace lies in the love of life, existence, and being in constant awe of all its ramification. The more I think about it, the more convinced I become that the lack of reverence for all of existence is the root cause for human violence. This irreverence often causes deep resentment, ridicule, and sometimes violent behavior toward those few who profess love as a way of life or a path to peace. If I think about it in concrete representative terms, the two individuals who leap to the forefront of my mind are Mahatma Gandhi and Albert Schweitzer. I have long been in awe of the magnitude of existence with its infinite levels and or dimensions, which stagger any attempt to understand or explain, no matter what icon is used to pinpoint them. Even so, I am beginning to believe the very vastness and elusiveness of the phenomenon of existence is not only, in itself, the ubiquitous and eternally sought for secret of the universe, but it is also one of the primary characteristics that give my perspective evidence there is, indeed, a common thread which links each particle with every other particle and the whole of existence, the key contributing factor to my newfound belief that peace on Earth is possible, and perhaps, if we envision it, inevitable. As I have intimated, I presently believe that civilized humanity's quest for concrete, immediate answers and solutions has overcome many problems, but the resulting success has also divorced the human species from its instinctive awareness of its origin, as well as its relationship with the rest of nature. Whereas primitive humanity was an integral part of the landscape and accepted nature on its own terms, civilized humanity increasingly pushes the environment into the background and seems to regard its creator, the eternal plasma of existence, hence the age-old symbol of life springing from clay, as something to conquer and exploit, declaring war on everything in the way, including itself. I am not ashamed to be human, neither am I a doomsayer filled with despair at imagined human annihilation. I feel we as a species can and will somehow and at some time arrive at the understanding that we must merge our powers of deductive reasoning with our long-neglected instinctive awareness of the supreme value and inevitability of an intrinsically equitable and organic relationship with the rest of existence. The powers of reasoning, deductive and inductive alike, that have utilized their creative and constructive capacities to lead us to the brink of planetary disaster, if not absolute annihilation, can and will, I believe, achieve the merging of cultural creativity with instinctive understanding regarding intrinsic equability of all existence, the factor that will snatch peace from the oft-ridiculed realm of sublime fantasy into the world of reality. Although there is no reason to suppose that humanity will suddenly become altruistic in an inherently indifferent cosmos where existence itself is the common thread that links everything to everything else, I believe the same characteristic that led the human species to try to dominate nature will necessarily lead it back to harmony within the dynamics of ebb and flow and the other organically natural processes, which will be a major contributing factor to the ultimate cessation of the cancer of human warfare. The creative element in humankind will enable it to tear down the walls of imagined superiority in order to reestablish the umbilical connection with our origin. Perhaps I am naive, but I believe the road to global peace lies in the assumption of its inevitability. From my perspective, military preparation physically and psychologically not only causes war by inuring people around the globe to the possibilities of war, but also virtually destroys the hopes for a peaceful solution. Yet if we convince ourselves that war is inevitable, we as a result hasten to ensure its occurrence. Whether we acknowledge it, we will war to happen. Yet if the human species can gear itself for war, it can do likewise for peace. Contrary to the assumed inevitability for war, a world without war is inevitable by substituting the inevitability of peace. This notion may seem oversimplified, but its logic compels me to make a committed effort to go beyond merely protesting a war here and there into the realm of total pacifism. It is often said that nobody wants war, but that it is sometimes necessary. And by the same token, the people who make the claim also intimate that peace is blessed, but not for the real world. But what seems absolutely absurd to me is the supreme sacrifices most people make for war, or in belief of war, or because of war, but not in behalf of the peace they claim to long for. I believe that the hope for peace lies in persuading the populace that peace is available and that its price is much less than that of war. Even if one dies as a result of nonviolent struggle, its price is less than that of dying in armed conflict. I know I must die sometime. I cannot imagine a nobler way of doing so than by peacefully protesting an atrocity of some kind, such as war, and such a death would be infinitely more preferable than dying while engaged in snuffing out life. In my view, war is legalized mass murder, and as such, should and can be peacefully banished from the face of the earth forever. Words are more easily said than the act can be done, but the task is possible, and its problem surmountable. No doubt historians and others will disavow the possibility of such a banishment based on the fact that all previous attempts have failed. They will probably declare that military force is the only means of guaranteeing peace, and even that is open to extreme doubt. But force is not the road to peace. It has always failed. Only love and the value of love of all existence and existing will enable us to make the commitment necessary to take the abuse that one must peacefully accept and confront in working for global peace. Far from being a new idea, the struggle for peace has been advocated and tried for thousands of years with a certain amount of temporary success by strong-willed leaders and dedicated, responsible, and highly disciplined disciples who recognize the inherent weakness in a status quo ruled and protected by military order, tyranny, and other manifestations of oppression and violence, all of which constitute war. Envision that peace, not war, is inevitable. Imagine the possibilities, reads a sign I produced after a peace demonstration in an effort to express my epiphany that a world without war or armed conflict is inevitable. I am aware that this is by no means an original concept, yet it is an idea whose merit is largely ignored and not taken seriously. If we were to regard war as an impossibility, we not only would not waste our energies, our taxes, our resources, our time preparing for such an act that irretrievably destroys and kills, but the lack of such preparation would also enable us to devote all of the above to improving the lot of life on Earth. But of course, there are those, probably most of the world's population, who will tell me to get real and stop living in a fantasy world. Many will express the viewpoint that war has always been and always will be, that war is nature's method of population control of the human species. There is no way to ascertain that war has always been. But even if it is true, our existence would not be if such a factor were a valid criterion. Everything has to begin somewhere in the dynamics of the ever-changing universe. That is, whether or not war has always been, peace could be around the corner. As for population control, birth control is much to be preferred to war. It is both a scientific and religious principle that action begets reaction. Preparation for war on the part of one political entity begets preparation for war elsewhere. But what if we were to take a different stance and approach with another attitude? The point I am trying to make is that since both science and religion are part of the evolutionary process and are examples of the channeled, if misguided, genius of the human species, and since the evolutionary process depends on the adaptability to change of each species in order to survive its environment, both religion and science will eventually join forces and combine methodologies in order to return to an instinctive awareness that all things in existence are equal and related. I speak with the conviction of an optimistic atheist. It is this atheistic optimism which spurs me to promulgate the use of willpower or persistent creative visualization as the initial step toward the goal of world peace as the only viable means of global survival. The idea is to speed up the evolutionary process through attitudinal and other social changes, as I believe has been the case throughout human development, in order to influence human behavior to regard peace instead of war as the natural condition of life. As such, we must learn to respond to whatever differences arise in a conciliatory manner. We must learn to respond to hostility, tyranny, and the like with nonviolent resistance instead of armed conflict. This will mean the possibility of being defenselessly killed, but such action, in the spirit of Gandhi, will not only enable us to die for the greatest cause of all, world peace, but it will provide us with the opportunity of knowing we have lived and died with the honorable distinction of not having taken a life. Perhaps I am not being very realistic, but I honestly question the use of weapons as a means of defense, even in warfare, when weaponry simply increases the odds of not surviving. It seems to me that the only purpose of firearms is to kill, and killing is an affront to peace and should never occur, even to retaliate, except to prevent hunger. It would be perfectly valid to ask if I would voluntarily risk my life for such a venture. The answer is I am not sure, but I think I would be more inclined to volunteer for such an action than for war, which I would resist. I can imagine myself marching peacefully in the face of danger carrying no weapon, for I would not want the opportunity to call upon the savage lurking inside me, which might kill everything that gets in my way and would probably result in my being gunned down more instantly than the peaceful approach. In short, the only hope for global peace is to think peace, to imagine that war is passé, that it cannot possibly happen again. The nations and the peoples of the world must disarm. They must exchange the illusory security of self-protection for the little-known security of openness and mutual trust. There must be no option to peace. We must enforce peace with peace. Unlike war, peace is not a halfway proposition. This means that in order to sustain peace, we must be ever vigilant for the slightest hints of war. We must negotiate for peace. We must fill ourselves with peace. We must build for peace, conduct ourselves in a peaceful manner. The list goes on and on. But let us glance at the opportunities offered in a peaceful environment, for I have heard it claimed that war generally generates technological progress and spurs the human species to creativity. However, if a momentary spur of creativity actually occurs as a result of warfare and military arms buildup, it is soon followed by an extreme drain on the economics of warfare factions, depleted material resources, and the abject squandering of human life, all of which adds up to disaster that far outweighs its so-called band-aid healing effects. Global peace, on the other hand, would support an attitude as well as sustain an environment complementary to the notion of cultivating an Earth agenda, which considers the well-being and improvement of all existence. The world would still be less than perfect, and in all probability, the conditions of peace itself would present problems of their own, but at least there would be considerably less bloodshed, as well as more time and resources to devote to constructive purposes. With the passage of time, perhaps eon, the uniquely human compulsion for acquisitiveness might possibly dissipate through evolution and be replaced with a natural sense of cooperation and peaceful coexistence as the tried and proven technique for the survival of the species. And that was Peace is Inevitable. Arthur Honeyman wrote many books, a number of which were about physical deformities and the problems the crippled, spastic, the blind, and deaf have coping with society's disregard and avoidance of them. He was also author of the award-winning Sam and His Cart, and he published anthologies of his poetry through Wheel Press, which he and his wife Joanne founded. He had a master's degree in English. Arthur was the most remarkable person I have known, and I compare him with Helen Keller, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and one of his favorites, Albert Schweitzer. His passing has truly been the world's loss, but it is a richer place because he lived. This has been Michael McCusker. In the words of Edwin Starr, war, what's it good for? Absolutely nothing.